Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, this time episode 116. And I'm here, as always, with my good friend, Zhao. We're going to do a podcast titled A CVE by Any Other Name. How you doing?
All good. As always, it's a pleasure being here with you, Jay. Yeah, very poetic name. We'll be talking about naming stuff, naming CVEs, why people are using different systems to name them. We'll be talking about names for threat actors, because everybody loves a really good Midnight Blizzard from Microsoft. And to top it off, we're going to end with a feel-good story about law enforcement for a change.
Yeah, that's what we're going to go over, all that and more. So before we begin, just getting a little bit of housekeeping done or some things I should mention. First of which, I'm less than 50,000 subscribers away from a million. So if you haven't subscribed, please do. It is getting close. I can't believe it. I don't even think I thought at the beginning that I would hit 400,000, let alone getting as high as it is now. So I appreciate everybody supporting us and keeping everything going. It's been an incredible experience. And, I'm aiming for the sky. So hopefully multi-millions, but for right now, I'll settle for 1 million because I'm really close. Also, when it comes to keeping the lights on, I have a lot of new products in the Fourth Wall Shop, merch.learnlinux.tv, a lot of cool things there. So buy yourself a shirt, stickers, buttons, a cup, a backpack, mouse pad, desk pad. There's all kinds of stuff there. Again, merch.learnlinux.tv. You could order yourself something nice and help support Linux learning, and I would really appreciate that. And with all of that out of the way, I think it's time to get into our very first story of today's episode.
Okay, so remember a couple of episodes ago when we covered that issue with the CVE program, where it's probably a near-death experience for the CVE program, when the Department for Homeland Security in the US said that they were going to pull the plug on funding for the project, so MITRE was going to shut down the NVDB, something like that. Anyhow, the problem was that without MITRE running the program, essentially the CVE program would stop working. You wouldn't be able to get new CVEs assigned, it would probably lead to conflicts, and essentially everybody in the cybersecurity world just freaked out about it. It was a very big sink. I don't know if we managed to get across the point that it was massively important that the program did not shut down and it would be kept running. Lots of people were seeing the writing on the wall for many different cybersecurity software and solutions and processes, and everything depends on CVE identifiers being there. And we were very, very close to losing them.
And we didn't even know we almost lost it until we found out that we almost lost it. And it wasn't an April Fool's joke, even though it was in April.
Yeah. We knew the day before that it was going to stop being funded the day after. So, yeah, there wasn't exactly lots of time to do anything. So everybody was paying attention to that. Coincidence or not, apparently this is a result from a 2022 bill. The EU has just launched the EU Vulnerability Database. That's EUVD. The timing, I mean, this comes from a 2022 bill, the NIS2 bill directive that the EU passed. One of those things in that directive mentioned that it should have a way to track vulnerabilities, a standardized database for that, essentially replicating what the CVE program was doing. And coincidence or not, a few days after the CVE thing happened, this was announced, essentially a month after that.
Yep.
It's essentially a database. It fills the same role as the CVE program does. It's funded by the EU. It also shows the CVE identifiers when one is available, but it tracks vulnerabilities with their own identifier. It's a different identifier when a CVE is also assigned for the same vulnerability. It's mentioned in the EU vulnerability database, so you can look at the vulnerability there and see the CVE. You can search for it. Actually, and this is just a side note, but boy, they really got the search function right for this. If you go to EUVD, if you just Google EUVD, you find it immediately. The search function there, it's pretty, pretty good. We mentioned this when we covered the CVE problem. The potential deaths of the CVE project was just that big of a deal that someone had to do something and someone would step up and do something. This is the result. This is the one of the things that has resulted from that incident. And this is what happens when strategic programs like the CVE project, first, are not funded adequately, and secondly, are controlled just by one entity that proved to be unreliable.
Yeah, and for people that didn't see that episode, some of the points that we brought up of why this is such a big deal is because the CVE identifier is how we refer to CVEs. It's how policy, you know, when we have IT policy, you know, you have to patch vulnerabilities that have a score of a certain height. And that helps sysadmins know what they should be targeting. So obviously, if something's rated a 1 out of 10, it's not that big of a deal. If it's a 10, it's a huge deal. But without that labeling, then everyone kind of just has to decide for themselves what to patch. We might not be identified the same way because we're just relying only on the vendors to tell us when there's a problem, which historically has not really been all that reliable. So having you know, universally unique identifier, if I could use that term, to, you know, every piece of malware, every vulnerability, it has a name. We can all refer to it as the same thing. It just helps us stay synchronized in the industry. So if someone is talking about a CVE number, everybody's talking about the same thing. But without that, you know, obviously we're just kind of scrambling to keep track of all of this. It's hard enough to keep track of it even with CVEs. And almost having lost this without any notice, without any warning, any chance for the industry to do something about it until after, you know, they, you know, at the last minute there was funding, it survived. But as we talked about that episode, it really kind of put into the spotlight what would happen if we lost this. And now we have the EUVD, which is, you know, essentially solving the same problem. They're telling us that this is a complement to CVEs, not a replacement. But at the same time, if the CVE program does lose funding, then I would think, you know, with this being the furthest along, it might even be the only replacement that we have. Then it would be, you know, a front runner for replacing CVEs should we need to. But the biggest thing that we brought up is, in my opinion, if a single government controls a vulnerability database, that in and of itself has problems if it's just, you know, in one basket. So that's, you know, obviously you could watch the episode for more than what I just mentioned, but those are the liner notes of this. So the EUVD, you said 2022, right? So this wasn't really, or so it said, not to be a direct response, but at the same time, the timing is pretty incredible that this is announced around the same time as we had that problem.
We'll probably never know, but the timeline for this probably was rushed when that thing happened. So, yeah. It's also important to consider that there may be further changes down the line. So right now, CVEs are important for what you just said, but they're also important for compliance. When you're meeting some compliance standard that requires you to patch a vulnerability within X amount of days, usually it's tracked from when the vulnerability is made public. That means when the CVE identifier is assigned and disclosed. When you have a different database filling the same role, you might start to get compliance requirements that mention one or the other. For example, for companies doing business in the EU, it's not unreasonable to expect that in a couple of years, in a couple of months, in the foreseeable future, compliance requirements might change or regulations might change in such a way that companies will have to track their vulnerability management processes in regards to EUVD. Right now, EUVD and the CVE database are perfectly aligned. Let's hope it continues that way. Mm-hmm. There might be changes down the line that differentiate them in some way, and that might make your compliance meeting requirements change slightly. So keep an eye out on that if you're interested in it and if it's relevant for your industry, for your organization. But pay attention that having a different database, having another database meeting the same goal, filling the same role essentially, might have some more changes coming along with it.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a certain comic strip about standards. We need a new standard. Now we need a standard to standardize all the standards.
Yeah, XKCD is always like that. It has a few enhanced features and functionality. Like I said, the search functionality is pretty good, especially when you're used to just MITRE's functionality. This one is massively better. Take a look at it. It's really, really improved. There's also three different dashboards that you can use. You can have a dashboard just showing you critical vulnerabilities. You can have another one, and this is especially good one. Exploited vulnerabilities, meaning stuff that's actually being exploited out in the wild. And then in a moment, I'll tell you why this is different than CISA's known exploited vulnerability. And then you have EU-coordinated vulnerabilities. The last one might not be as relevant if you're outside the EU, but essentially it's a way for the certs for the different European countries to work together when there's a new vulnerability that targets, say, European infrastructure or companies directly in Europe, and there's a way to coordinate the disclosure of that vulnerability. It will inevitably make its way to the CVE database as well. It's just that it might appear here first for a matter of minutes or hours or whenever they synchronize. The reason I mentioned the exploited vulnerabilities dashboard, the known exploited vulnerabilities list from CISA is something that's updated like every couple or every 3 weeks or every month or something like that. This one seems like it's updated on the fly. Whenever you get notice that something is being exploited, it's immediately reflected on the UVD. It's actually a pretty good dashboard. It essentially has the same vulnerabilities on one and the other, at least from the search results. It gives you more or less the same numbers, so it should be the same ones at this point. But the dashboard makes it pretty accessible for everybody to check that. It's easier to parse than the non-exploitable vulnerabilities list from CISA, at least from my point of view. And I really like how they implemented this.
And search is so important in this scenario, because if you can't search for information, then the information isn't really all that great. You need to be able to find the information you need, and you need to be able to find it quickly, especially dealing with security. So I'm glad that they took that seriously.
Now, the issue with this is, again, this is true for Linux distributions. The concern is fragmentation. When you have two databases, they're only going to be very friendly until they're not. They're going to be in sync for as long as possible, but there might be a point in time where they stop being in sync. So you'll have different databases that you need to check against. That introduces a whole host of problems. Then you'll have to check for vulnerabilities on both sides. Your software, your vulnerability scanners, whatever, will have to fetch both databases. We'll have to identify where it's matching the same thing, where it's referring to different vulnerabilities. Fragmentation surely is a risk. Everybody knows that it's a risk here, and there are concerns about that. There's concerns also on the compliance side, like I mentioned. If it makes meeting compliance requirements harder by having different compliance requirements, say, in the US and in the EU for tracking the same vulnerability, then that's a problem as well. This is especially relevant for larger companies that do business on both sides of the pond. So you might have vulnerabilities tracked by the CVE program that are disclosed in one day, and then the next day they're disclosed on the UVD. That's a problem, because your timeline for patching that vulnerability is different for both sides. You should be patching them as soon as possible, but that's not always possible, as everybody knows. So, yeah.
I guess, to your point, how effective the synchronization is between the two, we can only know that with time. As it ages and things get added to it, we'll have a better idea over time just how synchronized it actually is. And also, to your point, you know, things are synchronized until they're not. Obviously, I hope that they keep it synchronized. I'm sure that's an important factor, but, you know, we'll have to just see how this plays out, because it's definitely a developing story, and I think it's one that's going to be developing for quite some time as the service comes into being.
And because naming and does not apply just to CVEs, we have a story that starts in a pretty funny way. So it's like that joke in the bar. Microsoft and CrowdStrike enter the bar, and it all goes downhill from there. So Microsoft and CrowdStrike, two names that everybody associates with good cybersecurity practices and no incidents all whatsoever, are finally tackling a very big problem. We always make fun of those weird names that security companies use to refer to threat actors and to threat groups. You have Cozy Bear, you have Midnight Blizzard, you have App 29, whatever.
Salt Typhoon.
For example, those weird, weird names. It's not just the vulnerabilities that get silly names. The threat groups get silly names as well. The problem here being that each of the cybersecurity companies, the big ones, the ones that track threat actors, they all have some naming scheme that they apply to threat actors. And it's individual to that company. The problem there being that when you have an attack, when you're trying to handle a situation that happened to you, and you're looking up for more information, and you manage to identify the threat actor because of some signature that you found somewhere, and you want to know how they operate, what type of services they usually attack, what's their modus operandi, if they usually use spear phishing, if they do some campaign after the incident, and you want to get more information about that. Since each of the cybersecurity vendors names them differently, you'll have a hard time Googling the information for those threat actors. You'll have to know beforehand that they're handled with different names at different companies. Mandiant might have some name for them, Microsoft might have another, CrowdStrike might have another, the Talos Group might have another. It's really difficult to track that. If you think about it, this is essentially the same problem that existed before we had the CVE program. The CVE program was created in the late 90s precisely to handle different companies treating different vulnerabilities with different names. It was a standardized way to refer to vulnerabilities. Microsoft and CrowdStrike right now are trying to tackle the problem of addressing threat actors by just one identifier across the entire industry. You can't imagine how practical this is going to be, how much easier it's going to make your life when you're trying to handle these type of situations, but finally somebody's trying to do something about it.
Yeah, with Microsoft on the job, then we'll be able to better recall threat actor names. I had to.
You don't really hear this very often, Microsoft and CrowdStrike is the lead for a positive cybersecurity story, but yeah, it's both ironic and unfortunate given how large they are.
And it's like they're, from the notes, they're using a system like Blizzard, meaning Russian actors, Typhoon means Chinese, Sandstorm represents Iranian, and Sleet denotes North Korean actors, with Dust referring to Turkish groups. So they have a name for the origin of the situation.
Again, I don't know exactly what type of naming structure they're going to adopt, but just getting them to agree that something needs to be done about it, that's a step in the right direction. Creating a mapping system that works across all of the players in the cybersecurity industry. I mean, you might see software that, in addition to tracking vulnerabilities, also lets you track the threat actors behind the exploits of those vulnerabilities. That's pretty good from a defensive posture because you'll have more information available. Imagine if you're suffering from a ransomware campaign, if you have a couple of systems down. Like I said, you manage to identify the threat actor because it leaves a special signature on the encrypted files, and you manage to assign that to a particular threat actor. You look up information, you know that they usually go after spear phishing campaigns after the initial attacks, so you know that you need to advise the people working at your company that beware of emails coming up in the next few days because we know these guys are going to try that. So it helps to get this information. It helps to be able to track this. And it makes it faster, the response time. When you're looking up information, when you really desperately need to know what to do and what systems to look at first when something bad happens, speed is critical. Being able to look up information across all the different vendors, all of that, it's difficult to underscore how important that is.
Yeah, it matches habits to the name of a group or a name of the group to, you know, the habits that are typical of that group. And that makes it, easier because you're suffering from something, you know, you find out the origin is, you know, X group, then you know basically what they're going to try or what things to look for. And like you said, you know, the naming thing is getting ridiculous, like the naming vulnerabilities, naming, you know, the threat actor groups and the CVEs. And obviously the CVEs are important, but it's a lot to keep track of. So any information service we can have that helps, you know, tie everything together, just like you said, makes it a lot faster for us to figure out what's going on.
And then like some efforts in the industry that start with smaller companies that really don't have much traction. Having this started by Microsoft and CrowdStrike, and having Google's Mandiant and Unit 42 from Palo Alto Networks coming up and saying, okay, we're interested in this, we want to contribute to this, this will probably be adopted as a standard sometime in the near future. And that's pretty good. Yeah. It means that something is actually going to be done about it. The problem is real. The problem needs to be solved. And it's great to see companies with the muscle to actually make this work. You're probably going to start seeing references to new whatever naming scheme they come up with. And that one is the one to use. So whenever you're reading documentation or whenever you're looking at information from a particular CVE that says, okay, we know this is being exploited in the wild by this particular threat actor, and you'll be able to know what that is referring to.
Yeah, so far we have two ways of looking up information and tying things together, so that's always helpful.
And now we have the feel-good story about law enforcement. As we've repeatedly said, there's this economy in the cybercrime industry, there's a whole economic model behind this, they're very professional, there's lots of money changing hands here, and they have really different services. One such service was taken down very recently. It was called AVCheck. If you're familiar with VirusTotal, VirusTotal is a service where you can upload a file and it will tell you if it matches any virus signature. So it will essentially tell you if it's a clean file or not. AVCheck is something that goes a bit beyond that. AVCheck would let a hacker upload a piece of malware, and AVCheck would look at it and it tell you if, okay, this will probably be picked up by antivirus, it has this signature or it does this thing that's usually picked up by antivirus, you might want to change that so that it doesn't get picked up. This was a paid service for malware actors. They would upload their code there, they would make the changes based on the recommendations, they would upload it again, see if it was clean, and if it was, it was very likely not to be picked up by AV. The feel-good part about this is that law enforcement, essentially the from the US, from the Netherlands, from Finland, had an operation, I believe, last week, 2 weeks ago, where they took down the service. They identified the servers, they took them down, they will redirect you to one of those service seized pages from the FBI with all the logos if you try to access it right now. And it was a severe blow here. This was something that was being actively used and actively deployed to ransomware creators. And not having this available means that the quality of the ransomware will hopefully go down and it will be more easily picked up.
I wonder how many software as a service platforms exist for threat actors. I know quite a few, but it's just, and now one fewer, you know, and this is, it's interesting because Symantec, I think it was some years ago, said something about antivirus being dead, but apparently not because they still need to check for it. And yeah, that's a big blow. They have to work a little harder to evade antivirus at this point, which is what we want.
So this was an international law enforcement cooperation. Like I said, US, Dutch, Finnish agencies working together. This is impossible to stress enough. There's no way that a single country can solve cybersecurity alone. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't matter how much resources you throw at this. The internet has no borders, but law enforcement has jurisdiction only up to the border. It's impossible to fix the problem when the threat actors are living somewhere else where you can't reach them, or where the services are hosted somewhere else where you don't have jurisdiction. And agencies working together like this, it's essentially the only way that some damage can be done against this type of threat actors. The not so good thing about here is because this was a paid service, this was making money for somebody. There's an incentive for somebody else to put up some type of replacement service really quickly. You don't actually get the people behind the service. You take down the service, you take down the infrastructure, but whoever came up with the idea for the service is probably at large in one of the safe havens out there. And it will likely be replaced. But again, until it reaches some type of critical mass point, it won't come up in the in law enforcement radar again so that it gets targeted again. Cannot stress enough how important it is in transnational cooperation. Having any other type of strategy in fighting cybersecurity and believing it can be done just at the national level by your own agencies, by throwing lots of money and expertise to your own agencies, and that's that. That's never going to solve the problem. You will always continue to have threat actors coming up with great ideas on how to make money and how to affect your services, regardless of how good your cybersecurity measures are.
It almost makes me think we need a TV series that's accurate when it comes to the technology and shows both sides, you know, fighting each other and going, because I mean, that's, it feels like that sometimes. There's just so much to it. It's just, you know, threat defense and threat actors are both a huge industry, as we talked about many times. I mean, it's financially motivated on the threat actor side, obviously. You know, otherwise, why would they do it? You can only do a few pranks and then get tired. But, you know, it's financially motivated. We have the companies out there that threat actors work within that even have their own HR departments. Another thing we talked about, you know, they have they could talk to HR and complain about another threat actor employee if they have a problem with them. They have company events. It's treated like a real, you know, these places are treated like real organizations, and they're on their toes. And that's why we have to be on our toes, because like you said, I mean, it probably is only a matter of time before someone responsible for AV check takes the source code and does a find and replace for the name of the service and sets it up somewhere else, or just reinvents it. But at this point, we'll just have to keep our eyes on it to see what comes out of this. For right now, it's a win, and hopefully that win is maintained.
I mean, when I mentioned safe havens, keep in mind that as recently as 2018, and there's data for this, as recently as 2018, and again, this is going to sound really bad, but as recently as 2018, there are studies out there from cyber incidents from all over the world. Russia and Ukraine were allegedly the source for over 98% of all cybersecurity incidents worldwide. That's massive. And right now, you have those two countries in a situation where trying to do any type of law enforcement is either impossible because of everything that's happening, or there's no way you can deal with those governments in any reasonable way to enforce any type of sanctions for these type of services. There will be safe havens for those threat actors that live there, safe havens in the sense that they're outside the reach of law enforcement, and there's not really much you can do against it right now. This is a terrible situation. It's awful for everything that's going on, obviously, but it's also really difficult because of the issues that it causes on cybersecurity. And it's not just cybersecurity incidents between themselves against each other. It's because of all the criminal enterprises that are based there on either one of those countries. And we've known historically that for many reasons, it's always been difficult working with these countries to try to fight this. Corruption, whatever. By the way, there's a link on the description for this podcast episode. There is a great story there from the Technology Review, from MIT's Technology Review website. If you're interested in knowing more about this type of operations and how they work and why it's very, very difficult to actually pull them off, follow that link. It's a long story. It reads like the plot for a movie. Unfortunately, it's real. Again, great story, great read if you have some time free in your hands and you're interested in this type of things, because we cannot in any meaningful way get across the idea that how difficult it is to go after this type of individuals when they're involved in these operations, and how everything around them and the infrastructure and the countries where they're based off essentially is protecting them. They have the money, they have the resources to make themselves unreachable. They control the agencies that try to fight these type of things, so you will have no traction when you're trying to do coordination across borders, even if you're law enforcement. So you'll always have to fight around this. And the way that you do this is with operations like this. You take down the services when they're hosted outside of the services. You take down DNS to how unreasonable or how low effectiveness that has, but those are the things that can be done, and even that is difficult to coordinate. So every time that there's an operation like this and you see services taken down and you see people being taken into custody and being made responsible for what's happening, that's always a win because of how difficult it is behind the scenes to get that everything working correctly.
Yeah, definitely. It absolutely is. And I'm happy they're doing what they're doing and have a feel-good story in regard to law enforcement is refreshing. I like that.
For a change, right?
Yeah.
This is part, and this is just the final notes on this story. This is part of a larger operation called Operation Endgame. Again, naming is always a pain.
They must be Avengers fans.
Operation Endgame. Again. So this is part of that larger operation. One other thing that has been dismantled during that larger operation was a botnet, a Russian-linked botnet called Dynabot, which had infected over 300,000 systems. So we're always looking at this massive scale for everything that's happening in the cybersecurity world. The threat actors have lots of money, the threat actors have lots of resources. Whatever they're doing is always on a scale that's massively difficult to fight back and fight against. And this is the type of things that you need to protect your systems from. This type of networks, they don't happen because the owners of those 300,000 systems don't know anything about cybersecurity and don't apply patches. It's because these types of cyber criminals are always looking for new ways to break systems, are always looking for that kink in the armor where they can cross the firewall, where they can enter. They have an unconfigured service. There's always something that they use. You have to be secure all the time. They only have to be successful once.
That's a very good quote. I love that quote. That is absolutely the case. Yeah, 100%. We got to stay on our toes.
So, yeah, those were the stories that we had for today. Thank you, everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure. And until the next one.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you.
Thank you.